Welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Jonathan Lethem is, to my mind, one of the smartest, riskiest, and most experimental writers working in fiction today. He writes about crime not only like a fiction writer with all that propulsive page-turning thrill, but also like a sociologist, a psychologist, a historian, and even sort of a philosopher. That might never have been truer of his work than in his latest Brooklyn crime novel, which came out last year and is recently out in paperback. It's as much a book about gentrification, integration, race, class, economics, and all the things with coming-of-age stories like sex and drugs and skateboards and basketballs, as it is about what really becomes a character in this book, which is crime, mostly petty crimes that have big implications. The book is told in vignettes. It frequently breaks the fourth wall with the reader, mostly lacks character names, so it's kind of like a Rorschach test for all of us, especially in today's divided America. It gives us a lot to talk about. I feel like Jonathan writes about Brooklyn the way Tim O'Brien writes about Vietnam, with this kind of intimacy and respect and maybe a tinge of resentment and ambivalence for the way the place shaped who he became. I don't know if any of that's accurate, but hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about all of that. He is the author of 13 novels, including his 1999 blockbuster Motherless Brooklyn, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award and was made into a film by the same name in 2019 by Ed Norton. Fortress of Solitude, published in 2003, also delved into the streets of Brooklyn and race and gentrification. In addition, Jonathan has authored 4 story collections and 10 other books of essay collections and other things. He has been on the podcast several times before with me, but not since 2017. So we have a lot to catch up on. Jonathan Lethem, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back with you. And I love that introduction. The Tim O'Brien comparison is one I would never have thought of, but I like it.
Since you said that right now, and I was going to get into this a little bit later, but I heard you talk once about how the hard-boiled detective novel arose out of writers returning from war and their way to deal with trauma. And I don't know if now's a good time to talk about that or if we should get into the discussion more, but I'm really interested in that. I'd never heard that before, and I kind of wanted to get your take on that.
Well, I can delve right into that. It's one of my big organizing theories about like 20th century writing, but also just culture and life, what it's like to be a person who comes from the 20th century. Now we're in the 21st, and yet I just feel that the imprint of the two world wars is so deep on the collective human psyche and in ways that we haven't really gotten our head around, because it's so defining, you know. And a lot of what I love in writing, a lot of the art movements that shape my own experience and my own efforts, modernism and surrealism and the genres, science fiction and crime fiction, in some ways they can all be in different ways traced to this kind of disaster of disappointed modernity that is the First World War. You know, there was so much happening, so much optimism as the world began to kind of globalize with radio and travel. And then it was all sort of shattered by technological warfare, the onset of trench warfare and the disaster of World War I. And so much of 20th century culture comes out of that moment. I mean, basically all the modernists and all the surrealists and all the hard-boiled detective writers, they're, you know, these people were all traumatized by war one way or another. And exiles from Europe, I mean, the people who invented Hollywood, they're refugees from European war. And it's just, it's everywhere once you start to look for it.
Tell me more specifically about the hard-boiled crime novel coming out of that, because I can see it, but I want it explained to me a little bit better.
Sure. Well, I mean, one really simple way to trace it is to remember, of course, that the Black Mask writers, that's to say the writers associated with that magazine, that pulp magazine, there were a lot of forgettable ones. And then there were these sort of immortals who came out of that, Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and a handful of others, who formed this style that we now all take for granted. I mean, it's so familiar that it can just be, you know, satirized, people pretending to sound like a hard-boiled narrator are everywhere in our culture. But where did that voice come from? Well, one place it came from really directly was Hemingway, from these crime writers using that sort of staccato, clipped, reduced, embittered romantic style that Hemingway uses in his early short stories and in books like The Sun Also Rises and To Have and Have Not, which once you think that, it connects it so strongly to the idea of the traumatized war veteran, right? That's the main character in those Hemingway books, suffers the disillusionment and is broken in some way by that experience. And then you get to those writers, and they were mostly soldiers, and their characters were the image of the hard-boiled detective is this sort of character who's been broken by something and then carries on, but he's cynical, he's got this romantic streak that is armored now in his cynical style, and of course literally wearing a trench coat, which is an emblem of trench warfare. And so this idea that we might start to look at all of this stuff as really partly coming from the problem of who to be, what masculinity would be, what humanity would be after facing the anonymizing, crushing power of the First World War. And you have that reaction in other places. You have it in the Dada artists, who gave rise to surrealism. That whole movement was people who were basically asserting that nothing made sense anymore. After World War I, there was no reason to imagine that we were civilized and to instead just look at the undertow, the subconscious, the destructive impulse, the chaotic impulse, and describe it.
I love this. Thanks for unpacking that for me, because I heard you make that comment and I was like, I really want to delve into that a little bit more. And everything you're
I'm
saying
glad
is
you
making
asked. We
so
started
much
right in
sense.
there at the deep end, didn't
We
we?
did. Let's just jump in. As you're saying this, and I think this kind of dovetail on this discussion is, yeah, so I'm co-teaching a writing class now to older adults. And one of the themes is how we just cannot escape our childhoods, even if we're writing pure fiction, genre fiction, sci-fi, westerns, doesn't matter. Childhood is just right with us wherever we go. And as you're talking about these, the trauma of World War I and the trauma of World War II, but also the trauma of our childhoods. And obviously that's all over this book. But tell me a little bit about you trying to escape your own childhood, because I know you've made a couple of passes at this material in the past, and every time you make a pass through it, it changes and gets deeper and more nuanced and more, what do I want to say, more insightful maybe every time you come at it. And so tell me a little bit, maybe we start with your growing up in Brooklyn and how you can't get away from it.
Thank you. I'm glad you think that it's been worth my going back to the well again and again. I mean, to really tell this story, of course, first thing to say is, I'm not disguising my origin story. I did grow up in the 70s and 80s in Brooklyn at a time when New York City was a kind of wide open, chaotic, crumbling place, before it was regenerated with money and transformed with gentrification. And I watched some of the early stirrings of that in Brooklyn. It's hard to even fathom how far it's come now in its transformation, but I tried to record that with my writing everywhere I could. And I was a very direct witness. And it was about, for me, of course, about intimate, traumatic, personal experience. Being a kid on those streets was fascinating, challenging, and often terrifying. And I didn't think I wanted to write about that when I first started writing. I wanted to escape it in both my art and my life. And I ran away to California and I wrote stories, that I thought were just based on what I was excited and interested in. In many cases, those early pieces, the first few novels were, founded in science fiction. And I was writing about California or the West or sort of imaginary places. I didn't refer to New York even. And when I look now, of course, at that material, I see that I was interested in the inner city. I was writing about crime. I was writing about childhood. I was writing often about sort of feral childhood, street children who were having to make their own, invent their own world sort of out in a space that was not very patrolled or very surveilled. It was like they were living in a secret space where anything could happen. And I was doing that without even noticing that I was writing about Brooklyn at that point. And then I
Right.
made this very decisive turn where I both moved back to New York, and I did that. And after my, well, I guess it was just as my fourth novel, Girl and Landscape, was coming out, which was the first book that I'd written that did refer to Brooklyn, although the characters run away from it as I had. And I started writing about it directly. I just reversed every polarity, and I realized this is my material. This is who I am. This is my language, because one of the first things I thought about it was my voice comes from the Brooklyn streets. And that's why, Motherless Brooklyn is about this character with Tourette's, is that I was thinking about the brazenness and chaos and fascination of and kind of confrontational quality of the language of the streets. And that started to relate itself to the idea of Tourette's for me. So I made it my subject, and it turned out to be, of course, be a bottomless one for me. But the very first thing I did was write a kind of celebratory book. I mean, Motherless Brooklyn's a Valentine, really. It says, wow, this is so fun, and I love being from here, and everything. It finds the joy in this energy, this street energy. And I needed to do that, I think, first to kind of inoculate myself, and I don't know, kind of where I was from as a, to brandish it, to put it on as a kind of coat of armor. And then I could go deeper and really talk about the pain and the confusion that had caused me to avoid it for so long, where the fortress of solitude comes in. And that book was really a very much a, I mean, the character isn't simply me, and I'm always eager to point out the differences. There are many of them, but the situation that I thrust that main character, Dylan Edmondson, into was basically my life situation, the schools I went to, the streets I navigated or negotiated, and everything that I did to cope, which included fantasizing about transformation and about magic. And that all got into the book. And I also did a lot of work at the time for me, the most work I'd done in being kind of scrupulously sociologically accurate. I'd never written books out of research before. I'd written them out of my imagination. But with The Fortress of Solitude, I wanted to get some of the ideas that were swirling around in my head about the history of the city and its the gentrification of Brooklyn, get them right for the first time. And when I say for the first time, I mean in terms of that exact time and place. I had never seen any writers really do an extensive job of depicting it. There were glimmers in a couple of novels by Paula Fox and a couple of novels by L.J. Davis, but these were older writers. These were writers of the generation of my parents. And instead, I wanted to write about it from the point of view of the children on the street. And that seemed like it was there for me to do. And at the time, so then this is, book comes out in 2003, and I thought I had totally done it. I'd exhausted the material, and it was fine. It was great. I'd said everything that there was to say, at least by me, about growing up in Brooklyn. And I actually then, kind of avoided it again for 20 years, which is how long it was between Fortress of Solitude and Brooklyn Crime Novel. But I was thinking about it, and I was realizing, in that 20-year blackout, when I didn't publish or write directly about Brooklyn, I actually was formulating new thoughts and experiencing a lot of new feelings. And I was also doing more research. I was finding my way to ideas and information that I, the writer of Fortress of Solitude, simply hadn't had access to. And the key difference between those two books, I mean, there's a lot of differences, but the crucial change was that I sort of took the central kid, the surrogate version of me, out of the picture. I wanted to write about everything except me. I didn't want to do it as an autobiographical coming of age story again. I wanted to write about the surround and the social systems that I was beginning to understand, or I just anyway had so many feelings about, and thought that I was proud of The Fortress of Solitude, but in many ways it was a very traditional Bildungsroman or coming of age novel. I'd in order to grapple with the material, I'd use the model of like a Dickens novel, something like, Great Expectations, to put it all together. And I had other models that were helpful, Call It Sleep by Henry Roth. But I wanted to do something much more, well, difficult but exciting with Brooklyn Crime Novel, which was not reduced at all to one traumatized, sentimental character, but to talk about the entire space, the urban space, and what it was for all of the kids, and then also extend them in time, take them well beyond the limit of 2003 and say what it was like to be still thinking about this stuff when you were 50 years old or older.
Yes. And in those intervening years, not only were you changing and growing up, but our country changed significantly. And so I feel like the Brooklyn crime novel that was born today is born into a totally different America than Fortress of Solitude was born into 20 years ago. And we all are having to grapple with a lot of issues that I think in 2003 we weren't really thinking about in the way that we're thinking about them now. And so in that way, as I was introducing the book and saying it really is sort of this Rorschach test to hold up a mirror to all of us, even if we weren't kids in the 1970s Brooklyn streets, to grapple with all of these issues today is a much different experience, I think, than we all would have had, back then. And it's very relevant, very timeless. And I think a much more not important read today. It would have always been an important read, but a much different read today than it would have been.
Well, I think of it as a book that, I am just the writer in history. And Fortress of Solitude was written at a time before Obama and before the backlash against Obama and before Black Lives Matter. And in many ways, the story I was trying to tell was a story of a part of life that I think politically and culturally had been frozen.
Right.
It was under lock and key.
Right.
And then it broke open,
Yep.
defrosted.
Right.
And only under those conditions, and with the benefit of all of the understandings and new pain, also the new problems that we understood we'd been denying after the story unfreezes, could I explore it the way I did the second
Exactly.
time?
Yeah, exactly. Did you feel at all as you were doing this, in the last, what do I want to say? And I think we're recovering from it, thank God. But I feel like in the last 6 years of literature, especially, in the wake of Trump and through George Floyd, there's this third rail for writers of not being able to touch certain material unless you have the authority to touch it. You know what I'm talking about? And I don't know if that entered into your consciousness and was a distraction, or if you just, I mean, the way you do it doesn't really grab on and electrocute you the way it could, but it's there, but it's there.
Oh,
And
my goodness,
so,
sure.
tell me about how you thought even about that whole movement that we have been going through, your thoughts about that, and then B, grappling with that when you were writing this.
Well, so I, of course, it was with me at every level. And if I turned it in a certain direction, I could simply be terrified. I could think, I'm writing this, but I'll never publish it. But I also was at some level I had some tools. I was a somewhat of a veteran of this range of concerns. I'd had to make my way to writing about people other than myself, outwardly other than myself, to do the work I wanted to do a number of different times already. And I'd had to also live with the experience of publishing those works and knowing that that was complicated and the conversation around them was complicated. And that I was, what would I say, that it mattered to me so much to do it that I had to subject myself to the risk and the intensity and find my way. And the simple reason that that was true was that my own reading life was grounded in this notion of becoming other than oneself. Before I wanted to do it as a writer, I read that way. I read to be in places other than Brooklyn. I read to be in places other than the history of the United States. I read to be otherly gendered. And I just needed that thing that reading can make happen. And so I knew it, to me, it was innate in the practice. And so I had written a book from a point of view of a 13-year-old girl once, and I had black characters in The Fortress of Solitude, who I mean, in fact, the point of view character of the father in that book, Barrett Rue Jr., might have been for me the my favorite character I'd ever written. And I talked with my students and my readers about these experiences. I don't even think of them as, it's not about like claiming a license so much as it is earning an experience as a writer and then recording it with as much humbleness and love as you can possibly do. And this next book, Brooklyn Crime Novel, well, it has a kind of a tricky narrational move. It has this super omniscient presence that can do a lot of talking about these problems. And so, as these problems have deepened for people, I realized I had to conceive a book that where I could even say what I thought was so anxious. Like the book is partly predicated on, hey, this isn't comfortable.
Right.
Let's just go in and talk about that too,
Yes.
And I managed to get there and make a voice that was that allowed itself to name all the problems. It didn't solve them. I'm not claiming to have solved them, but I felt that maybe if I could just name them as faithfully and record them as honestly, scrupulously as I knew how, that it would be okay. And that was my hope.
Solving them is impossible, and even naming them is really tricky. So, yes, hats off for
It's a
even
lot to
attempting. It's a lot. Yeah.
even in them.
Well, I shouldn't be so presumptuous as to assume everybody out there has read the book. I tried to introduce it, but I guess just to be clear with people, maybe I'll let you lay a little bit more of the foundation for the book so that they understand kind of how this narration works, how these fragments work.
It's so
Yeah, go
tricky,
ahead.
and yet I've found some ways to kind of describe it. I mean, one thing that I've said to people is that this book is like a secretly a kind of documentary or oral history project smuggled inside a novel. The novel is about someone who grew up in a neighborhood that he feels, because the narrator eventually does confess something of his existence, he feels no one has understood or described, and that he himself is overwhelmed to try to consider. And he's going on a kind of a passionate quest to record all of the contradictions and just lay them out. And then there's a sort of a joke that I make there where I made up a character, this narrator who's writing this novel, that someone has tried to go before him and written a book sort of like The Fortress of Solitude, which he finds deeply unsatisfying. Because
Right.
it's too sentimental or too sweeping, or it too much uses the typical tools of the novel. And so this person thinks, I'm going to write a novel that tells the truth, but I think I also have to destroy the whole idea of what a novel is. So I'm going to take away your plot and your characters, and instead we're going to do something different. I don't know what it'll be, but we're going to do something different. And
Yeah.
so it requires a leap of faith for the reader to go along with this voice that's talking in their heads and saying, let's just move around. We're going to gather a lot of information before we say anything. And the information we're going to gather is going to be on this really simple idea. What is crime? Everybody in this neighborhood thinks they grew up in a crime situation. They feel like they're a victim. They feel like they're a perpetrator. They might feel like they're both, but what is it? So the narrator just kind of, it's almost like someone sitting on a bar stool beside you who's like, listen, we're gonna have to talk a while. This isn't gonna go smoothly because I'm gonna say a lot of crazy stuff. But crime is everything in this neighborhood. And until we accumulate enough examples, you're not gonna know what I'm talking about. So don't jump to any conclusions.
Yes. And some of them very funny examples. We shouldn't leave out some of the humor in this book because there are some
I
really,
think it's the funniest book I ever wrote, honestly.
So
Thank you.
it's told in 124, right? So it's like six sections, but 124 of these. I'm calling them fragments. I don't know if you agree with that.
I mean, they're chapters, of course, is what they
Vignettes.
are, but they're chapters in this most wide open sense that almost anything can qualify itself as a chapter.
I mean, I'm picturing you in your office or house or wherever you are, surrounded by 124, or maybe it started out as 3008 vignettes. and trying to move them around and make order of them because they're not chronological. They follow like an emotional logic, and they build on each other, but not serially, not entirely linearly. There's a lot of space between some of the buildings. And I don't know how your brain works, but if my brain had to grapple with that, I'd lose my mind. So I'm trying to figure out what your house office looks like, how you did this, how you arranged these. If you were just writing kind of out of order, recording memories as they
Yeah.
happened, what happened here?
Well, I had to defy a lot of my usual habits. I mean, this was, the 13th or 14th time I tried to write a novel, and I had always been very, very dedicated to the idea of writing in sequence, that I wanted to build the book the way the reader was going to encounter it, so I would progress through the information, like kind of like a detective discovering their case, one thing after the next. And understanding its meaning, no matter how many radical ideas I wanted to impart, I figured time moves in one direction, the pages turn in one direction. I want to be simple in this one sense so that I can be complex in other respects. And in this book, I was working with my own shattered structure, and I was stuck. I was lost inside it for a long time because I was accumulating materials partly by these oral historical methods. I was talking to a lot of different people, and I even had a questionnaire for friends and acquaintances who'd grown up in the neighborhood, and I made them fill out. So I was kind of studying all this information and pulling out stories that mattered to me or reminded me of things that I felt. And I started to do what I'd never done, which is work with 3x5 cards. And I would, I'm not a very digital writer. I get really confused by spreadsheets. So I made physical cards, and I was, I had like a crazy wall, like the people in the movies do, where you are connecting things in a non-linear way. You're making webs of associational meaning. Of course, my crazy wall wasn't a wall, it was the floor. So I could just kneel and crawl around and move them around even more freely. I didn't have to unpin them, and I could just keep looking at them in different constellations. It helped, of course, that I had a few ideas about things that needed to happen by the end. Cards I needed to reveal, almost like a magician doing card tricks, cards I needed to reveal towards the very end. And I also had some ideas about certain introductory things that, you had to see the kids doing the silliest and smallest crimes first so that you'd understand how much those were going to build and connect to the larger implications in the story. And there's some chronology. I mean, more early things happen early and more late things happen late. So it's sort of like a, when you see a word cloud where the most important things are bigger, there was some relation to chronology that could help me. But I knew some other things had to move around associationally, like all of the subway stories had to cluster together for a while. And we, you know, and but again, this narrator was going to sort it out all out for me. This guy on the bar stool who was going to say, "All right, here's the deal. Hold all those other thoughts we're having. We're going to talk about the subway now for a while and just go at that stuff." And I found my way. But it really was like being not the way an architect understands a house, but the way a cat understands a house.
Just by wandering around. You
You've
know
got to
those
just go into different places. Yeah.
I can't even remember what they called these, but they were like these electronically manufactured pictures back in like the 80s or 90s. I can't even remember when they were, but it looked like nothing. And then you let your eyes cross and then you could see a spaceship or something coming
Yeah.
out of it 3D.
You want to know a funny thing about that? I could
That's how
never
this felt.
make those work. People
Oh,
wouldn't
no. Oh.
believe me. I could never get my eyes to do it. So, but I do know the idea. I get the idea.
Yeah, when you stand back from this, each individual fragment is there, and then you stand back and you're like, I get the whole constellation of this place with all its intricacy and complexity and nuance. And I just read this thinking, how does his mind work that he could do this? We'll be back with more from Jonathan Lethem and Brooklyn crime novel in just a moment. You're listening to Writers on Writing. If you haven't checked out our Patreon page, I invite you to do so. If you are enjoying these behind-the-scenes conversations about how these books get made, or something an author has said has inched you closer to publication in your own life, this is your chance to support the show. Any amount helps us out. Visit patreon.com/writersonwriting. Every now and then we give out writing tips, prompts, we could do some book giveaways. So it's fun for us to be able to keep in touch with you and you to be able to keep in touch with us. And if you're interested in purchasing a copy of Jonathan's book or any of the books from our past guests, consider doing that on bookshop.org. Your book dollars go to supporting independent bookstores. A little goes to help out the show. You can find his book and others at bookshop.org/shop/writersonwriting. Let's get back to it with Jonathan Lethem talking about Brooklyn Crime Novel. Tell me about the questionnaire that you sent out to people. Like, what did you want to know? What were you searching for?
Well, I was trying to, get outside in the most pure sense, get outside my own suppositions and intuitions and memories. I wanted other people's. And with The Fortress of Solitude, that was the first time I really based a book on conversation and reminiscence at all, because I hadn't needed it for Motherless Brooklyn. I made up those guys. But with Fortress of Solitude, I was in a cluster of really close companions, my brother and my sister. And my friends Carl and Dione and Lynn, who grew up on the block with me, who's a very famous playwright now. And basically, that group of eloquent rememberers, as I call them, they remembered things with me, but they were my home team.
Yeah, right.
And I used them to reinforce the feelings and the memories that I was centering in Fortress of Solitude. With Brooklyn Crime Novel, I wanted to get outside my comfort zone, outside my home team, and I wanted to talk to anyone I could find who'd grown up on my street or the neighboring streets in that period of time and gone to the schools I went to or other schools and collect information, really almost like I was doing a survey. And so I was starting to reach for all these different voices, and I was, how did I do this? Well, I have a lot of nice connections. I'm very fortunate. I'm blessed in that way, connected to my old neighborhood. And I would go to friends of friends and siblings of the people that I knew and, try to just reintroduce myself. Or, it was usually people that we had some connection, but who I hadn't talked to in decades. And, in some cases, people who didn't even know I'd written The Fortress of Solitude. In other cases, people who were like, yeah, that book was okay, but that's not how it was for me. That was always a thought I was very interested in. And so I was just, and I, as I was beginning to gather this chorus of voices, I realized it would be interesting to systematize it and prime the pump of these conversations that I was having by giving a set of questions. So I made up a questionnaire with like 20 questions, mostly about experiences of crime in the city, doing it yourself, being the victim of it, but also the relationship to the idea of crime in your neighborhood, witnessing it, famous crimes in the city at that time. And certain things were very typical, like almost everyone mentioned Bernard Goetz and Son of Sam. That made sense. Those were the like organizing mythic crimes in our universe at that time. But then again, there were also amazing surprises. And when I asked people to talk to me about their relationship to talking to their parents about what went on in the streets, it was the one thing everyone consented to, that it was impossible. The world of the children was different than the world of the adults, and it was kind of incommensurable. So this became one of my motifs in the book, that there were these overlays of different worlds existing simultaneously.
Yes, especially in those decades, because we were all, I don't care where you grew up, it was a feral time. I think in a way the 50s weren't, and in a way certainly today is not. It really was a generational divide between, go outside, I'll see you maybe after dark, maybe not. And, I hope you're not even, I hope you're okay. Like, I don't even know where you are. That was unique to that time, I think.
Yeah, it was defining. And it's so different now. It can be hard to explain to people younger than ourselves how much we were free to self-invent and invent trouble too.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. I mean, this novel is such a study of memory and how memory works. And it's such a shape-shifting beast. And, thinking about the relationship between race and crime and cops today, when you're trying to access these memories, just seems like it would shade somehow your perception of what happened back then, knowing what is happening today. And I don't know how it would, but it just feels like it must. I mean, it just feels like accessing memories about cops and crime and race and all of those things then, we just see things, I think, from the vantage point that we're standing at when we're trying to think about what happened to us back then, which is why I think this is such a different book today than it would have been if it was written 20 years ago. And I just think that whole practice is so interesting.
Well, I was watching it happen over certain things were happening precisely again. The use of urban crime as a political rhetorical cudgel to frighten people into doing certain things. And I mean, even in New York City specifically, the new mythologizing of incidents on the subway, it was like the late 70s, early 80s were happening and were being reenacted at times. And it's just as I was writing it. So.
Amazing. The other thing I want to point out that you do is that I assume comes with the maturity of a writer is just using the whole arsenal of the keyboard in this book, from parentheticals to your really clever use of titles, to the repetition of words and phrases, to the white space, to the lingo, like it feels like you've assembled a toolkit over your decades of writing, and you're like, I'm going to bring it all to bear in this book in really interesting ways. And I don't know if you thought about it that way as well, of what can I pull out of my writerly toolkit to make this scene work in a really different, experimental, interesting way?
Well, I love that question. I haven't really thought about it so materially as you're putting it, and yet I think that's exactly right. I was trying to represent the space of inquiry, of thoughts about impossible things. And so I needed to, not just defeat the reader's expectation that this would be an ordinary novel, but also in some ways, this book was made in archives. It was made in clippings, it was made in fragments, and I wanted the material experience for the reader to be representational of that, so that they sort of had to make it out of pieces as well.
Yeah. Tell me about the relationship of music. I'm not really a wonderful wellspring of musical knowledge, but I know enough to know it was all over this book. And so I feel like music was probably an organizing principle in this in even deeper ways than I can understand. There's a section in here called Everybody Knows, and the whole section is everybody knows, like every sentence starts with that. And there are other references to music throughout, but I was wondering how you used music, like if you had a little running playlist in your head. I think at some point there was a little soundtrack embedded that you wrote out a soundtrack for us. Tell me a little bit about music and how you used it.
Yeah, well, so I made a running joke because The Fortress of Solitude had been so musically organized. The characters are all thinking about music, and there's so much music named and enshrined in that book. I made a joke that to do the opposite, I had to exclude music from this one. But of course, it snuck back in all sorts of ways because that is, it's very organic to that experience and to that life, and it's organic to how I think people in our generation access memory. So it was like the book was sort of fighting musicality and trying to hold it off to one side. But I surprised myself when I went back through and realized how many songs I named despite the boycott. Like it was all over the place.
Do you give yourself little tasks like that of like, here's a challenge, I'm going to keep music out of my work, or here's a challenge, I'm going to start every sentence with the phrase everybody knows, or like,
Yeah,
do you
well,
do?
I wanted there to be a lot of formal play. I mean, partly to keep the reader on the hook without the the normal kind of narrative suspense or character emotions. I needed the voice to be what was nourishing and fun and what kept you fascinated. So yeah, this was a book of patterns and play and poetry and echoes. I mean, the Everybody Knows came in some ways straight out of a book called Steelyard by Gilbert Sorrentino, an early book for him about growing up in Bay Ridge in Brooklyn in a very different generation. But he did this sort of mythic voice of the neighborhood, and I created that chapter as an homage to his.
It's not the song. I thought it was the song.
No, I love that song. So it's in there too. It's
Yeah.
helplessly in there too. And I know it's going to be in, it's not a surprise to me that you heard it because it's a generational song. Yeah, and it's going to remind people of the implications of that lyric,
Right.
that the dice are loaded.
Right. Yeah, and your staccato sentences, I mean, you vary your sentence structure so beautifully. I'm getting kind of into the writerly nitty-gritty now, but the phraseology on the street, the lingo on the street, the yeah, just the wordplay is really remarkable. I mean, I read so many of these sentences out loud to myself because I was like, I just love the sound of how you're creating this, not only this world, but these, kind of a lyricality in our heads. So that was really fun.
Thank you.
Tell me about breaking the fourth wall and when that kind of came about. It's a risky move, but it's a fun move. As you're talking about this guy sitting on the bar stool, telling us his stories, you would break the fourth wall. But did that decision, I assume, arose out of voice, and did it surprise you? And when did you know, okay, I'm going to play this key here, but I don't want to overplay it, but I want the reader to know I'm going to do this judiciously, but now and then.
I think that in a way, I knew all along that the book was going to have to dramatize the half-willing emergence of the narrator's presence. That this was the plot of the book in a lot of ways, was trying to speak for everyone, using that omniscient we voice, and then at some point faltering and saying, "You know what? I'm here. It's me. I can't help it." And that was the push and pull of the collective knowledge versus the individual intimate experience. And I had that in mind all along. I didn't even really think of it as breaking the fourth wall, of course, which is a notion from theater. And I'm always, it's interesting for me because I'm always telling my students to remember that novels draw on the theater, that you have to make scenes, you have to have staging, you have to have like entrances and exits. This is a really basic thing, and the reader will miss it if it's not there. But I was not thinking about theater so much as I was thinking about a genre of film called the essay film, where you can't really say what the logic of why you're getting all the different things you're getting it is, except that there's a voice. There's a narrational voice that's exploring something. It's the inquiry that is making the story happen.
I love that. Well, you brought up your students. Let's spend some minutes talking about what you impart to your students these days, some of these writerly lessons. I feel sorry for these kids who are just entering the writing scene today because I feel like the rules have changed so much in the writing world, in the publishing world, that I wouldn't even know how to advise people of embarking on this profession today. But you're dealing probably with more undergrads than MFA students, right? You're at
Yes,
Pomona.
I used to teach a lot of MFA students in New York, and I think that that's got, has gotten harder. I know from colleagues, from conversations, that there's something really can, I mean, it's always challenging, and it can always be heartbreaking. But I think there are extraordinarily unusual challenges right now, and it's wonderful working with undergraduates, not just because they're not holding off these professional notions, but because of the reason that they're not there yet is that they're still in this more playful, kind of self-inventing, polymorphous becoming phase where they don't even know what the writing might be for or whether it's part of their ongoing life. They're just discovering themselves inside it. It's a part of that radical period of self-invention that undergraduate colleges. So it isn't even so much that the pressure is taken off by that, but it's a marvelous kind of sandbox to be in with them.
Yes. They don't even know there's pressure out there yet because they haven't even discovered that, that they should feel pressure. I wonder if being in that sandbox with them helped you kind of stay in this mental state, coming of age mental state. Like, does their energy make that period of life a little bit more accessible being around them?
I'll say this. When I hear people saying the very ridiculous things they say about younger generations, characterizing them in these grotesque ways, I just always know how wrong they are. And that's such a relief to be like, yo, well, yeah, you definitely heard that somewhere and you're repeating it to me, but no.
That's right. That's right. Like. Yeah. That's not what they're like. Yeah, I agree. They're very sophisticated.
And so deeply balanced and not gullible.
Not gullible is
not
right.
Gullible.
Yeah. It's so funny for me to even picture you living in Claremont. You know, when I was booking you for our event that we're having together in town, people are like, well, he lives in New York. And I was like, he doesn't. He lives in Claremont. And they're
people
like, what? You can't.
It's very poignant to me because I feel I'm disappointing people so gravely that but that's the nature of my work, is that those books make one think that I could probably not. I'm like a creature that couldn't even survive not with my feet on the sidewalks of
right.
And but actually, if you read them from another angle, I have been formed as much by the pulling away from, the evasion of that place, the push and pull, you know. And ironically, the big Brooklyn books have almost exclusively been written elsewhere. I was technically living in Brooklyn when I wrote Motherless Brooklyn, but I was going up to Yaddo and writing that in the woods all the time, in all that silence. I was writing about the jabbering of the street talk and the Turetic utterances. And The Fortress of Solitude was mostly written when I was living in Canada. And now Brooklyn Crime Novel was written, not only was I living centered in Claremont, but I was expecting to do a lot of walking around and seeing people in person. And then the quarantine came and I had to do the whole thing on Zoom. So all of those visitations, all of the oral history work was done with people while I sat in my house in California. But there was something about quarantine. I think you'll probably remember this. For people our age, the emptiness of those days threw one so deeply back into oneself.
Yes.
And especially, I think, for people in their early or mid-50s, as I was, and the people I was reminiscing with, you know, you ended up helplessly in this introspection, even if you weren't a writer or a person who wanted to do a lot of remembering of growing up in Brooklyn, let's say, you had nothing else to do. In a way, you had to sit there during quarantine and figure out, like, who am I? And where did I come from? How did I end up here? Because there was nothing to do except introspect. So I gained enormously from that kind of sensory deprivation situation where, you know, I would get on a Zoom with people and I would say, so how was it for you? And 5 hours later, they would have told me things that they didn't even know they remembered.
That's right. That's right. And I was going to ask you how much ground touching you had to do with this novel to access some of these spaces, and maybe not being able to do that on the ground, being back there, was helpful because that's all you had to rely on were memories.
Well, it put me into the most extraordinary pressure chamber, because I declared this project that had to be absolutely not about myself.
Right.
It had to be about everyone else. And yet there I was.
Yes. I did this, you know, it was funny. I never do this with books, but because this was so grounded on these particular streets of Brooklyn, I did a lot of like Google walking up and down the streets, because I've been to Brooklyn, but I don't know Brooklyn very well at all. And so I was, you know, wandering Nevin Street and some of the other, you know, Dean Street. Of course, Google makes it look much different today than it did back in the 1970s. But I was, you know, just trying to get my bearings a little bit. That was really fun. I don't know if you did any, you know, the technology, say what you will about it, but there are some parts of it that are really very fun for writer research and reader research.
Well, you know, I already said that I'm a little bit Luddite-ish. I veer to the analog every chance I get. And the big revelation is that there is so much material that is not digitized. So even though I was doing remote work, I was doing a lot of remote work where I was making people go places and use microfiche on my behalf,
My
or
God.
photocopy piles of pages that were in archives, because there's so much. It's such a tempting illusion that, oh, everything is digitized now. You just know have to be really great at Googling and know how to find it. But there is an incredible amount of human knowledge that has not touched the internet. It's just moldering in piles of old newspapers or on microfiche machines. This became almost a totemic thought for me, that I was going to find the deepest, weirdest layers of things, thoughts that couldn't be thought.
Yeah, we didn't even get into these basement bookstore discoveries of material that's been entombed in some of these bookstores. I heard you are gonna your that's your retirement plan is to spend some time opening bookstore, true?
Absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. I actually feel like I'm even on a clock now. Like, I have it down to like one or two towns where my bookstore will be, and I think it will be between 3 and 5 years that I'll be doing it. It's a return to me, to a basic state of being, because that's what I did. It's the only job I had before I was an author
Yeah, yeah,
and a teacher. Is the
yeah.
only guild I ever really mastered was antiquarian bookselling. So, and I've been piling up the stock my whole life.
That's fantastic. Is this, can you either say East Coast or West Coast?
East Coast.
East
I'm
Coast, damn it.
ready to
Yeah.
cycle back. Yeah.
I knew it. Well, what's on your bookshelf these days before we go?
Well, what is I'm very enmeshed in research and also teaching materials. I'm teaching a course on Stanley Kubrick and his sources. So, he adapted amazing literary texts over and over again. So I'm reading Clockwork Orange and Barry Lyndon and the Traum Novel, the book that was the source for Eyes Wide Shut, and trying to figure out the relationship of these texts to the movies.
How cool. Do you let yourself read in any genre or not let yourself read in any genres you're writing? Like, are you trying to access a voice or are you trying to stay away from certain voices when you
I
write?
don't think of it as something there, that there's something to be avoided or protect myself from. That kind of prohibition seems misterioso and unnecessary. I read a lot of different things, and I read by instinct, and then I'll get programmatic about things I do want to read. Like, oh, I better read a whole bunch of this stuff because it's just I'm intuiting that it's going to be valuable. But there's nothing I try to avoid.
Good,
And
good.
sometimes the key thing comes from a really unexpected, random place.
Always. I think that's the superpower is finding the very archaic, random, whatever, and connecting it in. And those are so satisfying. Yeah, I think that's really fun to do. This was as much fun as I thought it would be.
Oh, I'm
Nah,
so
it's
glad.
more fun, more fun. It was
Thank
really great.
you. And of course, talking with you, I'm like, of course, I remember doing this. I can't believe I was forgetting that we'd had early encounters, but time is tricky these days.
Time is weird. I know. No, we waited too long, but we won't wait this long next time. I promise.
That's nice. I like that. And I love that we'll be hanging out.
I would do too. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That was Jonathan Lethem. The book is Brooklyn Crime Novel. It's out and available now in paperback. In addition to our Patreon page, you can always visit our websites. Barbara's is panonfire.com. Mine is Marie Stone, 2rsandmarie.com. You can always subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Stitcher, however you consume your podcasts. As always, our fantastic music and sound design is provided by Travis Barrett. You can find more typewriter music on Spotify under Just My Type. That's all the time we have for today. Tune in next week. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.